Hello, listeners. Welcome to another edition of Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the Nerdcast, Democrats continue to pad their majority in the House as races continue to be called. So why is the progressive left tempering expectations? We're going to get into that with a few of our campaign reporters and one of our congressional correspondents about how the new Democratic House majority is going to behave in a divided Washington. Plus, turmoil returns to the White House after a little bit of a quiet period before the midterm elections. We're going to talk about what's got everyone so riled up, who's leaving the administration, and who might have left the administration by the time you listen to this episode. Remember to stay tuned at the end of the show for a contribution from one of the Nerdcast's biggest fans. All right, let's dive right into our first data point, 12. Democrats will have at least a 12-seat edge in the House of Representatives in the new Congress. Now, there are a few different ways you can count this. They're up to 230 seats right now. That's 12 more than the 218 they needed for the majority. They've netted 35 so far. So their big night on election night keeps getting bigger as some late races in California and elsewhere around the country are counted. And again, I said at least a 12-seat majority because there are still some uncalled races that could go Democrats' way, especially two that are still outstanding in Southern California. Now, despite all that, there are still tempered expectations about what Democrats' new House majority can do. We'll tackle that with our panel here. We've got our campaign reporters in the studio, Elena Schneider. Hello, Elena.
Hey, Scott.
And James Arkin. Hi, James.
Good morning.
And on the line from the Capitol, Alana Shore from Politico's Congress team. Alana, thanks for being here.
Hello.
All right. So, Alana, I want to begin with you on the Hill. Talk to us about the fine line that progressives are walking as they look ahead to the next Congress, where, yes, Democrats retook the House majority. They're very excited about that, but there's still a Republican Senate. Obviously, there's still a Republican in the White House.
Yeah. So I talked to a half a dozen top leaders of progressive groups for a story this week. And, you know, the news may not be what you're seeing on Twitter, which is dominated by, you know, more fringy, more far lefty groups like the youth environmental protesters who occupied potential future Speaker Pelosi's office this week. That's all well and good, and it gets a lot of traction on social media. But the progressive groups that really influence the agenda are kind of hanging back more than you'd expect right now. And here's the reason. They know that pushing the House Democratic majority too hard, too fast will just exacerbate the existing tensions. It could actually hurt support for messaging votes they want to get eventually, like Medicare for all. It's not that they're saying, hey, you can do what you want, we'll just chill. It's more that they're saying, okay, you know, we like what House Democrats have planned for the first 100 days. We like to talk about minimum wage and infrastructure and pharma. You know, we are willing to give them room to maneuver on some more progressive priorities. Our biggest goal, this is the left talking right now, don't cut deals with the president. So that's what I learned.
Is some of this informed by what happened to Republicans after 2010 when their base essentially revolted against Republican leaders in Washington because the promises had been made that were not able that they were not able to keep? And I'm thinking particularly of Obamacare repeal.
Yeah, I mean, some of it. But honestly, though, their entire ethos is informed by the Tea Party. Nothing annoys these groups more than being compared to the Tea Party, because if anything, you know, they have not tried to undercut Democratic candidates with primaries from the extreme end of the spectrum the way the Tea Party did. They went out there and mobilized for candidates like Abigail Spanberger, who are certainly not big Medicare for all proponents.
Right.
So yeah, it's informed by that, but kind of like everything they do is informed by that. You know, I do want to, with a note of caution, say that it's mid-November, right? So we could come back in January and they could get into mad overreaching territory. But it was notable to me that you see PCCC, you know, one of the biggest progressive groups pushing for Medicare for all, saying, okay, well, we're fine with Pelosi doing a Medicare option for all vote.
And oh, that is interesting.
Yeah, and that's acknowledging the reality that, frankly, Pelosi herself isn't on record in favor of anything stronger than that. So it's like a cognizance of the reality.
Right, right, right. And that's a very interesting, different line than groups like the Progressive Change Campaign Committee took during some of the Democratic primaries that you were tracking all over the country this year, Elena. And I think it's interesting looking at this moment in the context of what we just watched all these Democratic candidates come out of over the course of the year, that a lot of these primary fights were not necessarily about substance. Some of them certainly were, but a lot of them were about style and identity and story as opposed to major policy differences, you know, with a deep abyss between the two sides of the party or things like that. And that seems to be playing into this.
That's absolutely something that I saw throughout traveling across the country in the last year and watching these primaries happen, was that I heard time and time again from voters that they just wanted people to win. I think that there was a reality or sense of reality about what their communities were like, and that some communities weren't going to go for somebody who was going to be a hardcore progressive. Obviously, there were some exceptions to that rule. I'm thinking in particular Data Balter in New York and also Carr Eastman in Nebraska. Both of those both of those candidates did not make it to Congress. And I think that more than half of the candidates who did make it to Congress haven't actually come out with vocal support for Medicare for All. So I think that there's an understanding of the kinds of candidates who actually won and who made it to Congress are much more diverse and maybe much less sort of hardcore progressive than maybe people expected who live in the Twitter sphere.
Alana, you mentioned the potential future once and future speaker Nancy Pelosi in here, and can you tell us a little bit about her? I mean, I'm guessing that her hand is deeply involved in this, right? Like she having kind of gone through some of this stuff before when Democrats retook the majority in 2006, has like a keen sense of how where to push and where not to push in order to avoid overreach and kind of getting into dangerous territory when you don't actually have unified power as a party to pass an agenda.
Yeah, Pelosi is extremely masterful at this. I mean, let's go back to that environmental protest I mentioned. You know, when my story ran, a lot of folks in that liberal Twitter sphere said, hey, but you're running the story on the same day that the kids are occupying Pelosi's office. Well, guess what? Pelosi immediately turned around and said, thank you, Congresswoman-elect Ocasio-Cortez. I'm committed to working together. So it all had this feel of like, okay, they almost like planned this. And this is not me reporting it. I'm just saying Pelosi has that way of messaging around challenges from her left. Now, we'll see if she's good enough to actually win the vote on the floor.
For speaker, you mean?
Yeah,
for speaker. That's like such a fascinating question. I'm totally fascinated by this. And
oh, it's riveting. But one thing we do know, whether or not she, you know, has her caucus in hand, she has messaging in hand when it comes to the progressive movement. And mm-hmm. I think she showed that in her very quick, very conciliatory and welcoming response to that youth protest, which, by the way, was not supported by any of the major progressive groups that Pelosi really needs when it comes to, like, let's get 1,000 people in front of the Capitol to protest against Mitch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a really good point. Elena, you just raised something that I thought was very interesting in the context of all this, was that the thing that you saw in district after district after district was voters concerned about winning in as they were considering candidates in these Democratic primaries. And James, I want to bring you in here to talk about that, because this broader discussion of how to win that the Democratic Party has been having and trying to figure out. And I think I have not seen as much kind of return to this after the midterms as I thought I might. I think we're going to see more as the 2020 presidential election heats up. But there's been this big fight between progressives who are saying you have to mobilize the base and with something to believe in to get them to turn out in order to win, versus kind of the more old school, I think I would say, like centrist model of trying to appeal to the median voter. Right. And that's a little simplistic. It doesn't necessarily have to be either or. But that's kind of been the outlines of the fight, that a fight that's been happening. And we saw this week that there was a big victory for one poll in that argument in Arizona, which elected its first Democratic senator in 3 decades. And that race was called a couple days ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Kyrsten Sinema, the Democrat in that race won and ultimately won, by a relatively large margin compared to kind of expectations going into the election and on election night when she was down. And
we're talking about what, like 2 percentage points at this
point,
right?
Yes. When I say relatively large, I mean that it wasn't a couple hundred votes. But she won by exactly what you said, running to the center. She, her TV ads didn't mention that she was a Democrat. She did not talk about, large progressive issues. She talked about bipartisanship. She talked about crossing party lines. She said that she wasn't a proud Democrat. She notably did not have a good relationship with or endorse the Democratic candidate for governor, who was much more progressive than she was, and she won the race. And so that's a big data point for Democrats who think, you know, if you're going to try and peel off, you know, Republican moderates and independents, and you're going to try and win in kind of red leaning territory or purple territory, you need to do it with that old school run to the center model, you know, versus just mobilizing the base. I mean, we saw some elections similarly where progressive candidates who tried to, you know, mobilize the base and bring out new voters weren't successful, and Kyrsten Sinema was. So that's a big win for that sort of line of thinking in the party.
I think there's a really interesting just like mirror image thing about Sinema, particularly on immigration, that I think about with, you know, she's going to be replacing Jeff Flake, the Republican who's retiring, who long before he gotten, you know, Twitter spats with Donald Trump that kind of tanked his popularity. There was a part of the Republican Party that in Arizona that really hated him already because they viewed him as soft on immigration. Same thing was true for the late Senator John McCain. And now we see Sinema, the first Democrat to get elected to the Senate in Arizona in decades. And also, what does she have in common with Flake and McCain is that she has regularly angered her party base on immigration. It's like the
it's a complete mirror image of the absolutely. I mean, she's probably fairly similar in terms of where she is on immigration with those two Republicans, and it's obviously a huge issue in Arizona. I think that is just Arizona is very you know, I don't know that you can extrapolate out in terms of you know, nationally for the parties. Arizona is its own thing, but it's clearly a sign that at least to win in that state, you need to run to the center, and your party base is going to be upset. But ultimately, you have to just hope that they're going to be there for you, even if they're going to be, you know, vocally angry about it.
And Ilana, bring it back to the Capitol and the new member orientation, the preparations for this new Democratic majority in the House. It seems to me like a lot of that thinking is kind of what's permeating what these new members are talking about at this point, and as opposed to the more Sanders or Ocasio-Cortez type of activity, like you mentioned with the protest and kind of calling for extremely dramatic legislative program.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps the biggest mistake we make when we talk about progressives is seeing them as a monolith, you know, which I address in the story. A group like PCCC has focused, yes, largely on Medicare for All, and now appears to be making a strategic calculation that, you know, pushing for Medicare option for all is a bridge to that future vote and success they want, right? But, you know, other groups like Credo Action, you know, are much more determined to just throw bombs because that helps them raise money, right? So yes, I think you're seeing the members not focus on this too much, but a lot of that is because these groups don't really have unity yet. I mean, there was this illusion of unity among these activists during Obamacare repeal because, you know, nothing brings people together like an existential threat, right? Like everyone can agree on the left that they wanted Republicans to fail. And now agreement is harder to come by. And I think that affects these members who are impressed by unity among activists, not disunity.
Well, that's a really good question, and maybe we can wrap up on this point. But so do you see a problem coming down the road once all these progressive groups figure out kind of it, or if I should say they manage to figure out what they want and get on the same page, or does if they manage to do that, does that just seem like something that's likely to find members on the same page with them as well, Democratic members?
I do think that's most likely. If we do see progressives come together again, I predict it'll look a lot like Obamacare repeal, where it's all kind of somewhat carefully orchestrated and calculated. But Dreamers is the big example of an issue where leadership wasn't necessarily ready to move, and the left pushed them all the way into a two-day government shutdown earlier this year, right? So we have precedent for the left getting together and forcing leadership to do something it doesn't want to do. Of course, it'd be a mistake to view that shutdown as a success. So I tend to think they may have learned their lesson, but we'll see.
Interesting. A lot of questions coming up about the, you know, how Democrats are going to govern in the House after an 8-year absence. And I guess we've still got about, what, a month and a half to go before they actually get sworn in and start doing this stuff. But a lot happening already. Ilana, thank you so much for stepping away to talk to us a little bit about it from the Capitol.
Absolutely.
And Elena, thanks so much for coming into the studio.
Thank you for having me.
James, same to you.
Glad to be here.
All right, we are going to transition now to our second data point of this episode, which is the number one. That's the number of White House personnel who have been fired this week so far, as of right now, 11:24 a.m. on Thursday. There's a chance there could be more, and that's why we want to talk about it. Nerdcast regular Nancy Cook is here from Politico's White House team to tell us all about it. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, thanks for having me, Scott.
So it's been a while since we've talked about the Discord at the White House on the show, I think in part because it seemed like it took a back burner a little bit before the midterms, but since the midterms, it's fired right back up again. There was a source this week that told you and another one of our colleagues that working at the White House lately is like being on the Maury Povich show, just without the paternity tests. What's driving all this?
Yeah, so here's my take on it. You know, and I've covered Trump World for 2 years now, over 2 years. So they were holding it together ahead of the midterms. You know, everybody wanted the focus to be on the election and, you know, trying to hold on to the House and the Senate. And I think that there was a mandate to keep the personnel stuff out of the news, you know, damp it down. Trump was off doing these campaign style rallies, which he loves doing. And there was just a sense that everybody was trying to put on a good face and not and make sure that the White House did not appear to be in chaos before a major election.
And then the election happened and all that potential energy is escaping any crack and crevice.
That energy is just it's like a geyser.
Well, so tell us what's happened so far. Who has left? Who is rumored to be on the way out? And how is Trump tied up in all this?
So there was one really interesting departure this week. Mira Ricardel, who is the deputy national security advisor, so she was the number two to John Bolton, basically got fired. And it seems like she's going to get another job in the administration. At least that's what Sarah Huckabee Sanders said. But she was ousted from the White House. And it came after First Lady Melania Trump issued a remarkable statement, something that we've never seen before, where she basically said she had her spokesperson, Stephanie Grisham, put on the record to a reporter that Mira Ricardel did not deserve to serve in the White House.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was a big deal. And, you know, first ladies have been always involved in personnel stuff. I mean, it's sort of inevitable that the pillow talk can spill into personnel. You know, Nancy Reagan famously had one of
Shadow chief of staff, right?
Yeah, was known as a shadow chief of staff, but also had one of President Reagan's chief of staff fired after he hung up on her. So there is definitely a precedence of this, but there's never the precedent of it being so public.
Being played out in the press. Hillary Clinton also had an enormous role in Clinton's White House.
Of course, both in the personnel and in the policy. And, you know, I think Michelle Obama was very influential with Barack Obama. But this was extraordinary because it wasn't like, you know, there was some article with unnamed sources about how Melania like stormed into the Oval Office and told Trump that Mira Ricardel had to go. It was that Melania issued her office issued her own statements.
And then the it seemed like the West Wing was kind of like twisting in the wind for a day.
People in the West Wing were like, I saw Mira, or she's still at her office. You know, it was like every hour, it was like a bed check. Is she still in her office? What's going on? Are the boxes packed? There were all these rumors going around.
Yikes.
And so it was just an extraordinary moment. It was also extraordinary because her boss, John Bolton, was abroad in Asia at the time he's traveling with Vice President Pence. So he wasn't even there. And it's sort of, you know, it's a long simmering proxy battle between John Bolton and John Kelly. Mira Ricardel had pissed off the First Lady in the planning of her Africa trip. That's sort of the backstory. And she's just pissed off a lot of people. She pissed off Mattis, the Department of Defense secretary. But that was sort of the key thing. But behind the scenes, there's just been all of this swirling personnel drama. The president wants to make a number of changes to his cabinet.
We've already seen Jeff Sessions go.
We've seen Jeff Sessions go. We knew that was going to happen. But that's another thing that's been swirling around. What is going to be the fate of Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen? What will happen to Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke? What will happen to Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross? These are all things that people in the White House are intensely invested in. And then just on a lower level, there's a bunch of White House staff that are about to leave. Some are going to go to the campaign. Some are going to leave because they've been there 2 years and they're tired. But there's just about to be like a huge amount of turnover in the White House. And that's kind of what everyone's really watching these days.
Mm. The cabinet stuff strikes me as, you know, we talked a few weeks ago specifically about Sessions and nominating a new attorney general and everything. Since then, it really, you know, we've seen late election results come in. Republicans are going to have at most 53 Senate seats in the next Congress. That's not as big a cushion as I think maybe they were hoping for. Certainly, I think that the White House was hoping for as they put up new nominees for the cabinet, for judgeships, what have you. Especially for attorney general, that's very fraught because of the Mueller probe. But it seems like there's a lot of opportunities for the White House to get hung up in big political fights over this reshuffling of personnel, over the, you know, it's Zinke, it's ethics issues, right? With Nielsen, it's extreme lack of chemistry between her and the president, right? It seems like the problem isn't going to stop once these people get shoved out the door because the Senate is pretty tight.
Yeah, it will be really difficult. And I think that we're seeing that already with the attorney general, the acting attorney general, Matt Whitaker, you know, who President Trump installed by tweet last Wednesday. There's a lot of questions about his past. You know, reporters are digging into it. And then there's questions about, you know, Chris Christie's name has been floated a lot for attorney general. He was at the White House last week for a pre-scheduled meeting already with Jared Kushner. But there's a lot of questions, like if Trump were to pick Christie, for instance. I've been told that a lot of people in the White House are very concerned that about him getting through Senate confirmation. And so, I mean, I think that the thing is that Trump is so frustrated with his cabinet and looks at it and is like, I want an A team heading into 2020. And I don't think is really that concerned with the nitty gritty of the confirmation battle. But White House staff around him are very aware of it. And they're looking ahead to that, just wondering, oh, gosh, how much oxygen is this going to suck up? And, you know, I should just say on the cabinet, we're taping this Thursday morning. You know, I was just on the phone with a former administration official who said that the firing of DHS Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen is so imminent that I should have, you know, Trump's Twitter feed open because it could happen while we're on the phone right now.
Wait a second. All right, let's open it
right
now.
Let's open it and see. Does she still have a job?
All right, nothing at the moment. So yes, apparently.
Yeah, and so it's just, you know, it's interesting because I'm not a reporter who gets really wrapped up in the palace intrigue of the White House. You know, I tend to like to write about immigration or trade or economics or, you know, other things. But this is the driving story out of the White House right now.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like there's much of the policy going on at the moment. It's all about, although I guess the president did hold that event at the White House yesterday about prison reform.
That's happening, and that's a big deal. And also the G20 is coming up, which is the big, you know, summit in Buenos Aires, Argentina. And he's going to meet with the Chinese President Xi and Russian President Vladimir Putin. And there'll be a bunch of trade stuff that will come up at that. But there's an interlude now where it's really about the cabinet and personnel.
Putting a bow on this episode, I think it's really big changes coming to Congress, big personnel changes coming to the White House and the rest of the administration. But in terms of the way the administration acts, maybe not big changes coming along. We know what we're dealing with at this point, as from the reporting perspective, in terms of what they do, all that stuff.
We do. I think the only wild card is, you know, we don't know exactly how the president is going to respond to having the House Democrats have oversight capability, and mm-hmm. we don't know how the president's going to respond to Mueller and that investigation. So there's going to be
where it goes from here,
and there's going to be a lot more outside pressure on the president and the White House than there was when Republicans controlled all of Congress.
That's a great point. All right, let's leave it there. Nancy, thank you so much for coming in to talk us through it.
I always love to come here. Thanks, Scott.
All right.
If I was young, I'd flee this town. I'd bury my dreams underground. As did I, we drink to die. We drink to die.
All right, as promised, we're going to turn things over briefly to one Nerdcast superfan here at the end of the show. Claire Burke, a Peace Corps volunteer in rural Madagascar, so no congressional district for Charlie to identify this week, is going to help us out with the credits.
Nerdcast is produced by Micaela Rodriguez with help from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is the executive producer, and their illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like Nerdcast and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, rate the show and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show.
Thank you, Claire. Listeners, we found Claire because she emailed in to say she was a fan. If you are a fan of the Nerdcast who wants to read the credits, let us know. Shoot an email to nerdcast@politico.com. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you again next week. I'm from Ithaca. I thought the snow was magical.
It's like, it's the gross kind of snow,
Well,
though.
Then I stepped outside and it was a little less magical.
Yeah, it's too wet.
Yeah, it was wet and sharp. It was sharp on my face.